This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Another day, another brilliant second half deserved upset. Japan turn it around against Germany, who are now in grave danger of failing to get out of the group. Takuma Asano, the hero, dragging the ball out of the sky and two touches later, hammering it past Manuel Neuer. At least the Germans stood up in a way to FIFA before the game had even started. Meanwhile, Canada run the old men of Belgium so close. Spain look ominously good, dismantling Costa Rica with the minimum of fuss. And are the Croatians finally tired? Their draw with Morocco, not really worth getting up for this morning. Also today is Harry Kane's ankle okay? Who's going to buy Manchester United? And tall policemen. All that plus your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Archie Rintutt, welcome.
Hello.
And hello, Mark Langdon from the Racing Post.
Hi, Max.
Sid Lowe will join us in a little bit. Johnny Liu was meant to join, but has no Wi-Fi and hasn't seen any of the games, but didn't tell us about that. So anyway, he might join us at some point, and if he does, he's always welcome. Adam says, can you slow down with the content? I'm still trying to hear who the dark horses are going to be from Group A. Yeah, I do appreciate there are a lot of pods, aren't there? But there's a lot of football. I'm watching four games a day. I feel sort of completely, I don't know, burnt out. You can't complain about just sitting on your sofa watching football, but it feels like a lot. Anyway, Germany won, Japan two. Is this the biggest result in Japanese football history, Mark?
It feels like it is. I mean, obviously, when they hosted the World Cup, they did well, better, I think, than expected, even though it was a soft group. But to beat Germany, a country that has got football influence in Japan, and if you go to kind of the Bundesliga, how many players are represented by Japanese players within the Bundesliga. I think that there is clearly a German influence on Japanese players. And so to beat them in such dramatic circumstances as well has to go down as a huge result. I mean, at the last World Cup, they were on the verge of doing that against Belgium, and then it all went wrong right at the end. So for them to recover from being 1-0 down, to take the lead and then hold on and not have, you know, a huge amount of scares in however many minutes of injury time we had in that game. I'm struggling to keep up with the amount of injury time. Now, I feel it must go down as their best ever international result. It does feel like a monumental occasion.
Yeah, and Archie, I know you'll see this from a very German perspective, but I found that second half, it just felt like it was coming, didn't it? It was like Germany were just sitting back and felt very open. And then that winning goal, I know defensively was bad, right? But the first touch from Asano is so good.
That's Takuma Asano of VfL Bochum, second from bottom of the Bundesliga. And Asano hasn't played for Bochum since early September as well. He also lost 7-0 to some of these Bayern players earlier this season. Japan changed formation at halftime. They went to a 3-5-2, a 5-3-2, and started going 1-1 with Germany in terms of the way that they pressed them. But as you say, it was only 20 minutes into the second half, really, that it started to pay dividends. And whilst I thought Japan took their chances well, I think one of the things that's being highlighted over here in Germany is the mentality side of things and how Bastian Schweinsteiger, who was the pundit on terrestrial TV here, was pointing out how for the first goal, you saw that Niklas Zula makes a big defensive error, as he describes it, by showing the attacker in on the inside when he has to be showing him on the outside. But also he just looked at the way that Zula and Leon Goretzka as well, who didn't start the game, just gave up. And then for the second goal, Zula, he says, again, made a very simple error by just not holding the offside line. And then we come to Nico Schlotterbeck, who I mentioned to you in the preview, Max. I mean, that may seem like a very long time ago by now. I get that.
Adam's just listening to that preview now, actually.
and one of the things that was said about Schlotterbeck starting the game was a big call by Hansi Flick, because even in his six international games so far, he's given away three penalties and he's been in really bad form for Borussia Dortmund. And you could see, I think, the thought going through his head when he's chasing Asano, and he's pretty close to him, that hang on, I can't give away another penalty here.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, so many things wrong from a Germany perspective. We could make a whole podcast about that alone.
But it had been coming. Like you know, just before the first goal, there was almost identical situation where Neuer parries it, actually made a brilliant save, and a Japanese player booted it over the bar, Mark. Like it really felt like you were just watching this game and thinking, Hansi Flick has to do something because Japan are starting to dominate this game.
They were. Mitoma, who plays for Brighton, who came on and was one of the subs that made an impact on the game. I mean, he's somebody that, I mean, I'd say probably the best player that I'd never heard of a couple of months ago. I don't even.
And God, if you haven't heard of him, blimey.
I don't remember him being signed by Brighton. And every time I've seen him play for Brighton, he looks a threat. I was surprised he didn't start. And then when he came on, I felt like, things started to happen for Japan when they could start getting players forward and actually go at the weakness in that German team that everybody had said, and Archie had mentioned it in those previews, you know, defensively was always going to be the concern. I would disagree in some respects though, Max, because I felt for at least an hour that the second goal was coming for Germany. And I think if they get the second goal, then, you know, we're just talking about a routine win. And, you know, there were moments, Musiala, that kind of slalom run that was just missing the finish. The Havertz offside that was, you know, really tight. Gundogan missed the chance. So there were sort of moments for Germany to have just made it 2-0 and we're just not even sort of speaking about any problems. But at the same time, Japan didn't attack that often, but when they did, they looked like they were going to score. And that has to be an issue when you've got Spain next needing to win.
That's the thing that you say about how the goal was coming. If you had no prior knowledge of the German coaching situation before this tournament, and I told you that Joachim Löw was in charge of this team, I don't think you'd be too surprised by that performance, particularly the way that things went in that final phase of the game. It felt like a highlight version in some ways of what happened against Mexico in that opening game. And that's part of the problem, is has enough changed from the way that Germany play since Joachim Löw left the setup? And having Hansi Flick, somebody who was an assistant to Joachim Löw for such a long time, but also the point you make there about, okay, but they didn't take their chances, but this has been the big point for many people in Germany, the fact that they don't have a number nine in a classic sense, or haven't played with one, and that it was Kai Havertz leading the line. I spoke in favour of Havertz on the preview pod, and to be honest, he was pretty bad today. So I think it makes more sense to probably play with Niklas Füllkrug for the next game. But the fact that Germany don't have that same quality of a number nine, and that leads Germans down the path of thinking about there being something wrong with the way that they bring their players through. I've heard from people within the German FA who talk about doing too many rondos and not enough one-on-one duels and too many similar players that they're bringing through. There's even a quote from, not from somebody from in the German FA, but Mehmet Scholl, very famous ex-German player, who's talking about how all these young players know how to fart out formations, as he so eloquently put it.
So, do you reckon Jonathan Wilson does that? Sorry, I picked the audience. I knew you'd enjoy that, actually, yeah. Anyway,
as somebody who's had the pleasure to have dinner with him at some point. Yeah, I don't know what it was, just mentally that image. I was like, can somehow imagine this. Yeah, so the point is that learning the trade of the game and how you develop a striker is not in the same way that you kind of coach these passing and combination machines that they have. So this team just, like, despite having lots of good players, doesn't really work and doesn't have as many world-class players in it as it did before, and is struggling to get out of that shadow. I think this generation of players is still trying to achieve success in the same way, in the same system, effectively, as the last generation, and more things need to change.
Do you think, Mark, you know, you look at Saudi Arabia beating Argentina, you look at Japan beating Germany, we obviously have a very Eurocentric view of football because that's the football that we watch week in, week out. It's a Premier League-centric and then sort of Champions League and Europa League beyond that. I know you watch sort of more leagues than I do, but I wonder, do we, like, are they just two freak results in that Argentina could have easily been 2-0 up and, you know, Germany could have been 2-0 up and we shouldn't read too much into it? Or that we kind of underestimate football, that we don't see that much?
I definitely think there's a freakness to it. And as I mentioned there, with the, you know, if Germany get that second goal, if Argentina get the second goal, maybe people have been bemoaning the fact that there's 32 teams in the World Cup and, you know, why have we got so many makeweights in it? And, you know, it's too boring. I do wonder, though, whether there is something in, because we had this in 2002 when that was a quick turnaround from then the season was ending. And, you know, they went straight into an early World Cup. This time, obviously, season's not ended, but, you know, there was no preparation time for the teams. Whether that in some ways has leveled the playing field, to some extent, I wouldn't go fully down that path because I think that, you know, there's just not been enough games to trust, sort of anything that's really been thrown out of the first few days. And it might just be some randomness, but there was a feeling, I think, from some that we might get some unusual results just because of the lack of preparation time just meant that it might mean that some of these juggernauts are not quite at it. I suppose in terms of home advantage, like there isn't any for most of the teams there, and that might help. It is in Asia. I know it's a long way from Japan to Qatar, but they will have at least been used to maybe playing in these similar conditions with qualifying. I mean, I am trying to just find narratives here to explain these results, and it might turn out to be complete nonsense, but there is definitely statistical evidence that backs up that teams play better in their own continent in World Cups. That is just an absolute fact. I didn't expect it this time around because of the vast distances between, you know, the likes of, you know, South Korea and Japan playing in Qatar. It doesn't feel like it should be home advantage, but, unquestionably there is something in the fact when you're on your own continent, results are better, and that is proven.
And what's the reaction in Germany? Like you said, that they have to win. They have to beat Spain now, don't they?
They do, because of the other result in this group already. The fact that Spain have won 7-0 against Costa Rica, meaning that, can you see that German side putting 7 past Costa Rica? If they were to draw against Spain? No.
Quite fun if that's what happens and then they have to score 8. You know, that would just be sort of mad, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would be. Just to come to something Ilkay Gundogan said, to pin it on Schlotterbeck and Zula, shall we say, for that second goal. The fact he said, I don't know if anyone scored an easier goal at the World Cup for that, tells you is I think a very clear message to his teammates there. Taking on the Mats Hummels role of calling out his teammates as he did in an interview after the Mexico game in 2018. And he also said going forward, not everyone wanted to have the ball. If you're Germany and that's one of the problems you have, you're in big trouble when players of that quality are saying, you know what? I'm just not quite there. And I think that this unconditional desire, as Manuel Neuer termed it, of Japan was also a key factor in the end in pulling them over the line.
Lovely moment with the Japan boss, you know, the scenes of the Japan players, you know, like all the subs running on when they scored the second, running on when they won was brilliant. The boss, Hajime Moriyasu, like they were in a huddle on the pitch and then they could see the highlights of the game on the big screen, sort of looking around, watching the highlights going, we just did that. It was great. A great question from Aaron says, what are your thoughts on Antonio Rudiger showboating, only to go on and lose the game? Should defenders ever be allowed to showboat? It was quite, he sort of went from sort of normal running to kind of, I'm not sure what, was it like 100 meter sprint? It was more than that. It was sort of slightly show jumping.
Prancing is how,
prancing, yeah.
It's how Daro Breen described it.
And apparently he's done this a lot of times before. Yeah. I just can't, does he do it quite a lot?
There's clips on YouTube.
Do you think he speeds up when he does that? Is it actually like a technically good thing to do?
I thought it was worse when he had that shot in the 96th minute from about 35 meters when, you know, there was an attack to sustain. I also found it, I think, a little bit harsh on Gundogan saying that there wouldn't be an easier goal, scored because Asano's touch for that second goal. No, I mean, obviously, someone as skillful as Gundogan would be able to do that, but I'm looking at it thinking, yeah, there are easier goals to be scored in the World Cup than that touch.
Was he saying easiest goal ever in the history of the World Cup? I didn't see Lineker v Poland.
That's the way I read it. I think he was also deliberately exaggerating because, I mean, the look on his face told the story as well. With Rudiger, by the way, in preparation for this tournament, when I was watching a few things on YouTube, I have seen Rudiger do that kind of running before, right, in a Chelsea shirt. And I think he's said as well that it's partly to do with kind of football should be fun, football's entertainment, albeit that, yeah, pretty soon after that, things started to go quite south.
Off the pitch, Germany's players placed their hands over their mouths, wore rainbow stripes on their warm-up tops and boots, following being one of seven nations banned by FIFA from wearing the One Love armband. FIFA said at the time it was due to the decision to bring forward their own no-discrimination campaign so that all 32 captains will have the opportunity to wear this armband. The Germany Interior Minister, Nancy Faeser, wore the One Love armband as she sat next to Gianni Infantino. And shortly after the game started, the Germany team tweeted out the following: "We wanted to use our captain's armband to take a stand for values that we hold in the Germany national team, diversity and mutual respect. Together with other nations, we wanted our voice to be heard. It wasn't about making a political statement. Human rights are non-negotiable. That shouldn't be taken for granted, but it still isn't the case. That's why the message is so important to us. Denying us the armband is the same as denying us a voice. We stand by our position." What did you make of that, Archie?
I tweeted something about what Thomas Müller was saying last night. He put out a statement on Instagram, which was that those who expect them as footballers to position themselves politically at the cost of their sporting dreams will be disappointed. And the point is, do they realize the human price that people have paid for them to realize this dream in Qatar? If we're going down to what the whole point that originally they're trying to make is. And the question to players that the heart of this whole armband saga has been, how much do you actually care about what has happened for this tournament to take place? Protest in a sporting context is about sacrifice for me. To label what the Germany team did as protest, to put it on the same, to give it the same word as what someone like John Carlos and Tommy Smith did in the 1968 Olympics, or to do what Colin Kaepernick did continually and actually faced loss in his career to make his point. It's just not anywhere on the same scale. They found...
I totally agree with that. You know, it's not comparable to anything like that.
They found a comfortable way, Max. They found a comfortable way to express it. And what does this achieve? The fact that FIFA have said that they're not going to take any disciplinary action, I think that it had got to the point where the next move had to be, if they were going to continue showing how much they cared about it, that, okay, you know what? Fine. But this whole, okay, well, you know, us players have no voice. They do. They have the power.
But don't you think in a way that it is embarrassing for FIFA that they're doing that? I actually saw it and thought, oh, that's good. At least they're doing something. And maybe my expectations aren't, you know, my expectations should be higher. I mean, I agree with everything you've said.
Football, Max, is so far behind the world that you and I live in, and Mark as well, outside of this. Can we still believe there is not a single openly gay player in the top five European leagues, right? Can you imagine that? And I think that by saying that this is a good statement, we are adjusting our standards to where football's at instead of where the world's at. And that for me is problematic. It's football that needs to catch up, not the rest of the world bringing itself down to the levels of football.
I mean, I agreed with you, Max, initially. I've changed my mind now. I've heard Archie. But I mean, I when I saw that photo, I felt that it was at least, you know, keeping the conversation going. And I mean, I suppose I wondered what the impact of the rainbow armband actually was anyway, and actually become more important when FIFA said that, you know, you get booked if you wore it. Maybe then it became more important. But to me, that almost felt like a sort of ticking a box as well, really, rather than actually, you know, really doing something that would make a difference. And I, until Archie had spoken, I felt that the German national team had at least done more than sort of most others. You know, we had the Australian video that came out, but it felt like, to me, a step in the right direction, albeit we are at a very low starting place with that.
While we're on this subject, The Athletic say Denmark have revealed they're ready to discuss a blanket withdrawal from FIFA alongside other UEFA nations amid the ongoing row over the One Love armband. It's not a decision that's been made now. We have been clear about this for a long time. We've been discussing it in the Nordic region since August, said the DBU chairman Jesper Moller. I've thought it again. I imagine that there may be challenges if Denmark leads on its own, but let us see if we cannot have a dialogue on things. Wales, by the way, Wales had a rainbow flag flying at training today. Also, Sean Ingle reporting in The Guardian that incidents involving the FA of Wales staff and Wales supporters having rainbow-coloured bucket hats confiscated are being urgently investigated by authorities. FIFA and the Qataris were in talks on the matter on Tuesday, where FIFA reminded their hosts of their assurances before the tournament that everyone was welcome and rainbow flags would be allowed. Interestingly, where this becomes complex, if you remember the LGBTQ plus special we did, was that actually the gay community in Qatar didn't necessarily want rainbow flags and all these kinds of things because of the fear of recriminations in Qatar when we all, you know, when we all piss off and you know, we're not talking about it. So, you know, that is just another interesting strand to this that I've been thinking about since we've seen this furore at every game and every moment and all these kind of things. Actually, what the impact will be for the LGBTQ plus community in Qatar after this, whether it makes any difference or not, I don't know. And on Wednesday, FIFA says it's opened disciplinary proceedings against Ecuador over homophobic chanting by their fans in the World Cup opener against Qatar. Right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin with Belgium versus Canada. Archie, you may go and you'll be replaced by Jonathan Liu in part two. Mark, you have to stay here if that's okay with you. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. We can say welcome to Johnny Liu. Hello, Johnny.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good. I was rude about you at the top of part one. I'd like to apologise because you are actually here.
I know. I'll find out what you said when I listen back to it tomorrow morning.
I mean, you know, as rude as I can get, which is not particularly rude. Kevin says, is Belgium-Canada the most dads v lads World Cup game you've ever seen? I mean, like, thing is, I sort of knew, Mark, about Alphonso Davies and Jonathan David, but the others, Buchanan and Johnson, et cetera, I didn't know about. I know Belgium won this game, but I feel like Canada were monumentally robbed in a way.
Yeah, they were. I mean, if you look at the stats, 21 shots to 9, and most of the good football was played by Canada. All the enterprising kind of tactical ideas came from the Canadian players. If Davies scores the penalty, I think you get a completely different game. Of course, he doesn't. It was a really bad penalty as well. You want your star man, I think, in those situations to be able to deliver. And he unfortunately couldn't, but played well, I felt, in the game. You know, it's a funny old game, Max, isn't it, football? Yeah. But if you know, Belgium have won and played much worse than Argentina and Germany, who've lost. And I think, you know, as we go forward in the tournament, if Belgium play like that, they won't be going very far, that's for sure.
Yeah, I sort of feel, Johnny, for Alphonso Davies. You know, taking a penalty is a skill and he didn't do it well at the time. But have Canada still yet to score a goal in the World Cup, right? There's such a pressure on that guy to score that penalty, to take that chance.
Yeah, and obviously it's... You know, it's probably, I mean, I know he's played in a Champions League final, but it's one of the, you know, the defining moments of his career. But the thing is, he had an incredible game. You know, he did so much. You know, we've seen him in that role so many times with Bayern Munich, sort of coming in off the left-hand side. And it still looks like an unusual kind of run. I still think teams aren't really kind of, they're not sure what to do with the left-back running at you. Like diagonally, the narrative, I guess, will be that like Belgium had the nous and the experience. They had the old heads, and you know, they showed Canada, you know, what it is to be a mature tournament team. But in no universe has that game gone well for Belgium. I mean, they got battered. Courtois kept them in it in the second half. So yeah, really, really impressed with Canada, and so many kind of good, you know, good vibes to take out of that game. You know, they will take a lot more confidence out of that game than, you know, maybe if they'd snuck a kind of a lucky draw.
Courtois does look incredibly big, Mark. But I was watching just as Alphonso Davies stood there, and a lot of people said that basically the ref made Davies wait a bit too long. But I was looking at Courtois going, God, the goal looks tiny. And Courtois, who does look increasingly like the policeman from Hello, Hello, he looks harder to score a penalty against him than most people.
Yeah, he definitely feels the goal when he's standing in it, and he kind of gets the hand span out, and you are wondering, well, where is the space here? You know, there should be like an 80% chance of scoring, but it maybe doesn't feel like it is when Courtois is in goal. I also like his technique of standing quite far behind the goal line, so he's still able to spring forward. But I mean, it wouldn't really have mattered what technique he used in this instance, because as soon as he dived the right way, he was saving it, because, you know, that the penalty was nowhere near the corner, and it was softly struck as well. And I think, as Johnny was saying there, just in terms of the unjust nature of the result, also in terms of the match winner, Batshuayi is the match winner, and you know, he goes home thinking how well he's done for Belgium. For the whole time he was on the pitch, he was absolutely terrible. Apart from the goal, every run he made felt like it was the wrong one. And De Bruyne, you know, was doing that kind of Cristiano Ronaldo style, throwing his hands in the air at just sort of the wrong run at the wrong times. He wasn't controlling the ball very well. And yet he pops up with the winning goal. And it just goes to show how stupid football can be, I think, sometimes.
But Belgium are old, Johnny, aren't they? Pete says, I know Belgium's a pretty small country, but why do none of their men aged between 18 and 33 play centre-half? Watford Zen says, considering the average age of the Belgian team, is the Belgian kit with flames on the sleeves some kind of collective midlife crisis? Now, it's funny to see Vertonghen and Alderweireld still there, just sort of lumping it away.
Yeah, and Alderweireld was playing in Qatar until, I think, until a few months ago. I think he moved back to Belgium now. And they've been the rock at the heart of that defence for 10 years, possibly even more. And there is a kind of, there is a point at which, you know, we talk about Gareth Southgate and his loyalty to the class of 2018. You know, this group has been pretty much unchanged. I don't think out of that first 11, like 8 or 9, at least, were there 4 years ago. And when you have the same coach and you have that, you know, you have the same core of players, you know, what you gain in cohesion at some point, you know, what you gain in cohesion, you sort of begin to lose in, I don't know, freshness and new ideas. And of course, you know, the physical aspect of it as well. I mean, I didn't think, you know, they had any, you know, particularly worse games than a lot of the guys around them. It was just the, you know, the fact that Belgium as a whole looked so leaden and so wooden, and when they, you know, when they were kind of passing it around, you weren't quite sure what they were trying to do or what their ideas were. And yet, you know, Alderweireld's the guy who sets up the winning goal. So, you know, go figure.
Well, we've seen that before, haven't we? You know, that long ball over the top, and it used to be Dele Alli kind of running onto it. That was a goal that, you know, as definitely in his repertoire of being able to do that pass. I was just surprised that Batshuayi managed to sort of sort his feet out in time on the one occasion he did.
Missy Batshuayi. Actually, you know, it's interesting you say that, Johnny, about, you know, being sort of sticking with the old guard. Because actually, when they bought Onana on, when they bought Trossard on, they were much better. And you sort of think, I don't know how hard it is to drop. Did the whole team walk in and say, you pick all of us or none of us? Are they saying, actually, will there be a press conference where Belgium say, you know, Jan Vertonghen's there going, I think we need Thomas Vermaelen and Moussa Dembele back in, and that's what will fix it?
Yeah, and, you know, and Dries Mertens, and you know, while we're at it, let's get Luke Nillis and Gilles de Bilder back. I mean, there was a lot of talk, you know, there's been a lot of talk in the last kind of couple of years about the new Belgian generation. I mean, at the Euros last year, there was a lot of noise about Jeremy Doku and you know, the players that were going, you know, Onana as well, another one, like the players who were going to ultimately take over. Right, I've spoken to people in Belgium, you know, in the last couple of years, you know, on and off, and they say that, look, this generation isn't, you know, it's not like there's nothing left after them, but there is a kind of recognition that these guys, and they're fed up of hearing the term golden generation, because they know, as we know, that it comes tinged with a slight, you know, a slightly backhanded compliment. You know, that England's golden generation won nothing, and Belgium's golden generation also look like they're going to win nothing. You know, it's, if you kind of know it's your last chance, these guys, you kind of wonder why they just didn't go at it a bit more. You know, they just kind of, they honestly look like they were, all right, one more then. Okay, we'll do one more together. And then I'm having a sit down.
Speaking of old people, Rob says, I have three kids. I'm 39. I'm constantly knackered. What is Atiba Hutchinson's secret? Yeah, 39 years old. Still did a really fine job in that midfield. I just thought, for a team, and we've got lots of Canadian listeners who are very excited about Canada qualifying, who talk to us a lot about Canada, and I didn't really watch any of Canada. It's probably the first time I've seen Canada play for, I'm going to say, even possibly my entire life, Mark. And I'm just so, that sounds really patronising. I'm just so impressed just with, like, I mean, the physicality, but they played good football as well.
They did, yeah. And I think that when you've got a team with that's got Alfonso Davies in and Jonathan David, you just hope that the others are able to kind of, I suppose, lace their boots, and it's not just them two doing it all. And it wasn't. As you said, Hutchinson really stepped up. I felt when they chucked on Larin as well in the second half, that gave them an extra body in kind of the attacking third of the pitch in terms of, like, when the crosses were coming in. I did wonder then if they maybe just lost something in terms of the control of the game, which can happen when you start chucking on more strikers. So finding that balance and getting that balance right will be important for the next two games. But I think we saw with Morocco and Croatia in the earlier game in this group that although they've lost the first game, it's not all over. You wouldn't be surprised if Canada were able to pick up points in these next two games. I also wouldn't be surprised if Morocco and Croatia took points off Belgium. It looks a really tight and close group that I don't sort of see a standout team in any of the four of them, really.
Just want to give a quick shout out to, not a shout out, but a word for Stephen Eustachio in the Canada midfield, who we haven't mentioned yet, but I thought he's absolutely sensational, passing and running and harrying and just basically being the, you know, being the heartbeat of things. I hadn't seen him much. I think he plays for Porto. I hadn't seen a lot of him and was really impressed with him.
I would like to give a shout out to Pierluigi Collina, who the camera cut to. And he was just talking to himself, like really muttering, like, I can only think he was just saying, there's not enough injury time. We need more injury time. Can we have some more injury time, please? It's a sort of disappointingly normal amount of injury time in this game. Anyway, let's go to the Spain-Costa Rica game. Before I get your guys' views on it, I caught up with Sid Lowe just after full time. How was that for you, Sid? Seemed pretty straightforward.
It was marvellously straightforward. One of those where you prepare the match report. You think, well, five goals is a nice round number. It works very nicely. There's a lovely intro. Oh, you bastards. You went to score two more in the last 2 minutes, which kind of ruined things. But I thought Spain were absolutely fantastic. There's always that doubt, isn't there, Max, in these situations, which is how much of this is about Spain? How bad are Costa Rica? Is this purely about one team or is it about both of them? But I thought Spain were exactly what Luis Enrique wants Spain to be.
Well, I mean, John Muller tweeted, he's watching Spain on Telemundo. The Arabic commentator in the next booth is screaming tiki-taka over and over at the top of his lungs. And it was quite tiki-taka-y, I thought.
Yeah, well, I mean, you only need to look at the statistics, over 1,000 passes. But this isn't the passes of yore. When it was 1,000 pointless sideways passes, there was incision, there was aggression, the speed of it, how wide they made the pitch. How much control there was in the middle, but also, as I say, the kind of the velocity with which they use the ball. And I think a lot of this is about Gavi and Pedri and how well they use the ball, but also to look at it through kind of the prism of Gavi, which I think is really important. A lot of the reason why I say this was the perfect Luis Enrique performance for Luis Enrique is he is so keen on the idea of the aggression, the intensity, the get the ball back very quickly. And there was a moment in the first half where Spain had the ball for about 2 or 3 minutes, well, it felt like 2 or 3 minutes, it might not have been. And the move ended up breaking down in the 6-yard box. We thought, well, that's fair enough. You know, the move breaks down there. Within a second and a half, it was back again because they just didn't let Costa Rica get out at all. And I think that's the thing that Luis Enrique will be most focused on, will be the sense that the team did it the way that he wants them to. You know, they were relentless. And, you know, having gone 4-0 up and they could have kind of stopped at that point, he makes a load of changes. Some more kids come on the pitch. Nico Williams comes on and plays brilliantly. Alvaro Morata comes on and scores. Carlos Soler comes on and scores. I've lost track of who the other substitutes were. Balde comes on and runs through them. And so I think he'll just look at this and think, this is basically perfect.
How was the atmosphere?
There isn't one.
Really?
Not really, in truth. There was a little bit of noise from a small pocket of Spain fans, a bit too many empty seats. I think a sort of a sense of watching a kind of if you like, an exhibition almost more than a competitive game, obviously probably doesn't help with that. But I think this was about watching Spain perform brilliantly. It didn't feel like a, as I say, maybe it was too easy for there to be an atmosphere, if you see what I mean.
And are you having a nice time?
No, not really, not yet. I think I need time, Max. I've been here for a few days. It was the first game, but it kind of feels like I've been here for ages. I've been really, really busy with the kind of the preview stuff. I've not really got out to see anything yet. But, you know, When it comes to it, it's a pretty good start, isn't it? I'm going to watch, I think it's 6 games in the first phase. I mean, I've basically got my quota of goals already, haven't I, pretty much?
Yeah, it's either a lot of goals or a 0-0. So, you know, that's it.
I'm sorry I've ruined the World Cup for everyone.
And who are you rooming with? You're not next to Ron A. and Wilson, are you?
No, I'm with Pete Patterson and Jonathan Liu.
Okay. Oh, well, we've got Johnny on. So how is...
Tell Johnny to put the kettle on for when I get back, will you?
I certainly will. All right. Cheers, Sid.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Sid Lowe there, who is rooming with you, Johnny. How is that going?
I'm currently in our living room. I mean, unsurprisingly, he's not back yet, or he's gone to bed. I don't know. But yeah, he's lovely. He bought a 6-pack of mineral water, which in these conditions is like gold. It's like the oil of the desert. So you know, he's great company, and also you get to see him preparing for his interviews. He had an interview with Iñaki Williams a couple of days ago, and you can see him preparing his questions, and he's still got an old school notebook but he's prepping his questions, but he's also sort of plotting the different ways in which the interview can go. And obviously there's like few better interviewers in football than Sid.
So he's got it all planned out, like sort of a roll your own adventure. I think I had an asterisk book. Well, you know, like it's like if Iñaki Williams says this, go to page 10. And if he says this, go to page 32. That is incredible preparation from Sid. Anyway, back to this game. Duncan Alexander tweeting, Spain completed 6 more passes in the first half than Wickham have in League One in November, which I enjoyed as a statistic. It was very easy, Mark. But Spain did play really nice football.
Yeah, it is difficult to know just how bad Costa Rica were and therefore how good Spain were. But I enjoyed, to a point, sort of watching Spain knock it around and get some shooting practice in. And all of the previews kind of leading into the World Cup were that Spain would dominate possession but would struggle to score goals. And then they had eight shots on target and 7 goals. I like the way that actually they play, and I know you like a big man up front, Max, but I did like the way that Spain played without a recognised number 9, Asensio, Dani Olmo and Ferran Torres, all just, you know, able to move around within that front three. It feels to me like that is a better solution for Spain, and Morata very much sort of comes in as the plan B if things are not working. And then Pedri and Gavi, but particularly Pedri in midfield, is just an absolute delight. And if you don't put any pressure on him, like Costa Rica didn't do, then, I mean, he is just going to be able to dictate a whole game. But for Costa Rica not to have one shot on or off target in the whole match maybe doesn't serve well to the fact that CONCACAF gets 3.5 spots in a World Cup. It feels on the upper end, really, maybe, of what... Because they've ended up playing a playoff game against New Zealand for a spot in the World Cup, having finished fourth in CONCACAF, which, that one of the easier paths, let's put it. I mean, there's a lot of teams in Africa that have to work a lot harder to get World Cup spots.
Mm. It was quite nice to see Sergio Busquets having enough time to be brilliant again, you know, because I don't know how often he is these days. Graeme Souness, Johnny, was very angry with Costa Rica for not just kicking Spain a bit. You know, he did mention, you know, how physical Saudi Arabia were and you know, how aggressive Japan were as well. And just saying, if you are the lesser team, and obviously Costa Rica are not as good as those two teams, you've got to do something.
Was Souness angry, or was he more disappointed? Because disappointed is worse.
Yeah, I think... Well, he once told me off for swearing twice when I was trying to get out of a bunker, and it was very much disappointed, not angry. And it was that tone, yeah. It was a disappointed tone.
Was this what, when you were both fighting in the Second World War?
I mean, it was more on the 15th hole at the Shire, I imagine. But it was very similar, you know. And if we were at war, I think when we looked at each other, Graham Souness would be more disappointed to be next to me in the trenches than I would to be looking at Graham Souness.
Well, you know, I'm quite pleased it's quite nice that Graham Souness was disappointed by Costa Rica. Costa Rica were very disappointing. We sort of knew how they were going to play. You know, they are one of the teams in this tournament who really try and set up and quite tightly and rigidly and try and soak up pressure. And I think one of the trends maybe at this tournament so far is that the lower ranked teams who have had some joy against the higher ranked teams have been the ones who have really tried to take the game, you know, have shown some ambition and aggression, you know, Tunisia and Japan and Saudi Arabia and teams like Iran and Costa Rica and Qatar to an extent who have tried to sit in. Elite footballers kind of spent the last 10 years, the world's best coaches have spent the last 10 years basically trying to, you know, working out and breaking down the problem of how to unlock tight set defenses. If you're an elite player in a big five league, that's probably how you spend most of your tactical training. And the fourth Spain goal was probably, I mean, that was probably the point at which, where they're basically all falling over. Everyone is falling over. And it's like you sort of, it's the sort of goal you used to see. It's basically like crap 90s football on a mud bath, at Loftus Road or Deepdale or somewhere. But it's a pristine, but you've got, the surface is offering you no excuses there. And somehow they just can't get the ball. They can't clear their lines. And they got a paddling.
Yeah, they really did. Lots of Pedri and Gavi stats. I mean, look, they've got a combined age of 37, which is obviously younger than quite a few people at this World Cup. Younger than Dani Alves, like younger than Thiago Silva, younger than Pepe. And I really felt for Clive Tilsley, who during the commentary did say, from all the tapes of watching Costa Rica, this is what I think. I think, God, you've had to watch a lot of... How many tapes of Costa Rica does Clive Tilsley watch ahead of a game? He's a pro, isn't he?
It's also pretty pointless, Max, because they don't play against Spain every game. So,
true.
When they're playing against Panama, maybe they sit up slightly differently to when they're playing against Pedri and Gavi.
So he watched it and it was pointless. Anyway, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll discuss Morocco 0, Croatia 0 and any other business. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Morocco 0, Croatia 0. I confess I took the first half off. It's the first 45 minutes I've missed. And I think I made the right decision. I mean, so little happened in this game, Mark, of note. I mean, Amrabat came on a bit late in the second half. Maybe he'd gone to the toilet.
It was a long time ago, wasn't it, Max?
It really was. I mean, it feels like it was years ago, but did anything happen?
Not really. I think Morocco were probably better than people anticipated coming into the tournament. They were able to match, I thought, Croatia for large spells of that game. It's not easy because Croatia, while they maybe lacked that Mandzukic type that they used to have up front, the midfield, it still remains one of the best in the competition. I felt Morocco stood up to that reasonably well. There was suggestions before the tournament as, you know, had a new manager, how would that all go? Seemed to work fine. I felt they were very competitive and have got a good chance of getting out of the group. And it wasn't the prettiest game, but it was a pretty important result for particularly for Morocco. And judging by what we saw from particularly Belgium, I think, you know, both will fancy their chances of beating them.
What did you make of this game, Johnny?
Well, I saw the coach, the Morocco coach afterwards, Walid Regragui, saying that basically if you lose your first game, then your dream is over. And I mean, they certainly played like that. In the context of you know, where Morocco are and where Croatia have been, it's a huge result for Morocco. You know, it's for the neutral, it's a pretty dull game. But, you know, there was a really great atmosphere. Obviously, lots of Moroccan fans have travelled. There was good noise. And that is really big for them. I mean, they will have seen Belgium and realised maybe they're not quite as daunting a prospect as they might have been. And they will go into the rest of the group thinking, you know, we've got a proper, you know, a really good chance of qualifying. And I think, you know, they set up again quite well and they closed down the midfield pretty well. And Yeah, that's about all I have to say about that.
No, there was a lot of closing down. I mean, it's a great observation for this football match. Hakim Ziyech didn't do a whole lot, Mark, but slightly unfortunate. John Hartson had thought he'd gone off, and there he was, still on the pitch, which is not John Hartson's finest moment. Was when John Hartson, as Andy says, question for the pod: have we hit peak World Cup with John Hartson talking about his granddad from Newfoundland fighting in the Second World War and moving to Wales at 11:05 on a Wednesday morning during the Morocco Croatia game? Well, Hartson had a great game in my mind.
I don't know if John Hartson's been the star of this World Cup. Actually, I mean, he's coming out with some absolute zingers every time I'm on the mic, and he's been mic'd up probably more than most so far. We had, you know, the best save he'd ever seen in one match. We also had him having not watched football for about 10 years because he couldn't understand why the flag was going up so late either. In the Wales game, I think you referenced it earlier, where he just started supporting Wales in the second half. So, I mean, I'm all for it because I think there's enough serious debate that goes on across the 64 matches that to have a bit of light-hearted John Hartson of the morning for Morocco v Croatia, I think that helps the World Cup tick along in my book.
Yeah, slightly disappointing for Bayern Munich. They've lost both their fullbacks to injury. Lucas Hernandez for France now, and Nassaye Mazraoui for Morocco. David says, not a question, but Modric looked tired. Even in the lineup graphic, most of the players step forward and cross their arms and give a big thumbs up or smile. He just looked like he really wanted a cardigan. Can relate, says David. And there was a wonderful, like you say, there were loads of Morocco fans, Johnny. There was one Morocco fan. He had maybe one tooth, and he was just so like giddily excited and sort of had like a ludicrous hat on. At least I think he did. And I was like, that is very World Cup. And he hadn't quite seen enough of that. Elsewhere, Harry Kane was able to train with his teammates due to have a scan on his ankle. I think a lot of people, when they saw that ankle go in the game against Iran, very nervous considering the state of Harry Kane's ankles. Jordan Pickford said, I think he is good. I'm sure he is fine. He was out on the grass today, which is good. He is our captain. So that sort of says it all about Harry Kane, so should be playing.
I would love to see England try and play without Kane. Obviously, I don't wish injury on Kane, but it would just be really interesting to see how Southgate sets that side up. He would probably just go with Wilson. You know, obviously he's a great player, Kane, but you take him out and you have decisions to make. I'd be really interested to see how that unfolds.
What would you do? Would you just play Wilson? Or
well, I would. I mean, I'd probably bring in Phil Foden, who has played that number nine role, false nine, you know, dropping deep role for Manchester City, and would give their, you know, would give that England attack a whole new dimension, because, you know, America will be preparing for Kane and will you have the chance to spring a surprise there, but it won't happen.
We had a few emails on this subject, and this one from Alex. Thanks so much for getting in touch. I'm writing with a plea that you correct and don't make the same mistake again when lumping Iran in with Arab nations. Iran is not part of the Arab world. The Iranian population is made up of primarily Iranic, e.g. Persian, Kurd, Baloch, and Turkic, Azeri, Turkmen, and Qashqai ethnicities, with Arab Iranians accounting for at best 3% of the Iranian population. It's been bad enough to hear ITV commentators mislabeling a nation of 80 million and a global diaspora of 4 million at a time when our people are fighting for their voices to be heard on the streets of Iran. To hear not one, but multiple panelists and Max Lumpers in the wrong demographics has been pretty painful. Loving all the work you've been doing, and hope that for the remaining two matches that Iran probably have left, you'll afford us our pride and dignity when discussing our next shellacking as Kiefer Moore puts a hat trick through us. Thank you, Alex. Look, and we apologise for getting that wrong. We are always learning, and thank you very much for telling us. footballweekly@theguardian.com if there's anything else that we need to get right. Steph says, does the £5 billion price tag placed on Manchester United when the stadium needs a complete rebuild on top of this mean the only eligible buyers are warlords and Bond villains? What's going to happen, Johnny, at Manchester United?
I think, you know, it would be great to see a Bond villain buying Manchester United, although you wonder whether somebody else would be able to thwart them at the last minute, because the Bond villain would just take a little bit too long trying to seal the deal. But we'll try and do it in a really elaborate and circuitous and tortured way.
Well, it's quite fun though that when Fred goes in for a new contract, and then, you know, he stands on the, you know, he stands on that chute where the shark is in the pool, you know, it sort of adds a bit more jeopardy.
I think from the Manchester United fans that you know, currently calling out Manchester City or Newcastle. We'd be interested to see whether they'd have the same feelings if, you know, all of a sudden they've got owners that, inverted commas, care about the club and, you know, start giving them the star names and new stadium that they've been demanding. I think the timing of it was very interesting, you know, so soon after Liverpool announced or released a statement that hinted that they'd also be available, because, you know, for Manchester United, I suppose they don't want to miss out in that sense, really. There's only so many billionaires willing to buy these Premier League football clubs, and it will, I suppose, be interesting to see which one the kind of bidders prefer. In terms of who comes in, I mean, I'm just going to lump all the Americans together, but there has been, you know, most of the kind of interest does seem to be in the US at the moment. And I do think we have to be careful as to when that then tips, you know, too far, because once any batch of owners get control of the Premier League, i.e., you know, that 14 of the 20 votes, you know, it then becomes very difficult to stop that 39th game or any other kind of weird and wonderful ideas that maybe would be seen to be in again, inverted commas, enhancing the game.
So either we have 10 games in Milwaukee or we have a rogue state owning Manchester United. That's the sort of, or Elon Musk, right? That's our choice, right? So, and who's the guy? Is it Jim Ratcliffe might be interested? Is that a good? I don't know enough about him to know whether that's a good thing or not.
Jim Ratcliffe can't possibly be evil. Jim Ratcliffe's, he's called Jim Ratcliffe. He's got an English name. He can't possibly be a bad guy.
Can't be a Bond baddie, can he? There must have been an English Bond villain by
Elliot Carver.
Oh, right, okay. And which was that one? Most recent.
Tomorrow
one.
Never Dies.
Okay, was that a good one?
No, it's not. No, it's the Pierce Brosnan one. He's like a newspaper baron. He's like...
Oh, yeah, I remember. He's got quite a nice face. It was in sitcoms, I seem to remember. Anyway, we'll find out and then we'll talk about it when it happens, I guess. Finally, Phil says, on the subject of tall players as policemen, I can confirm that Stockport County legend Kevin Francis is now a Canadian policeman. So that's sort of... I would be surprised if I got arrested in Canada and it was big Kevin Francis in a Stockport County shirt leading me away. Let's see, of course, he's now a Mountie. Even more exciting if he is on top of a horse. And that'll do for today's podcast. Thank you so much, Johnny.
Yeah, and apologies for...
No, don't worry about it. And thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Max.
You don't need to apologise for anything, Mark. You were here for the duration. The only one.
I wasn't going to.
Yeah, the hero. Football Weekly was produced by Silas Gray with Lucy Oliver. Our executive producer is Max Sarnes.
This is The Guardian.